Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're going to discuss today the issue of reparations for slavery, which is clearly a contentious issue and becoming more so as more and more institutions seek to examine their past, or at least examine their past in a certain fashion, and as there is, without a doubt, an increased amount of pressure for some or other form of compensation for the past in this fashion. What I want to try and do is take further my discussion in my history of slavery, and indeed also the piece that I did, the debate that I took part in the University of Pennsylvania last week, which is observable on their website. And I want to really cut to the quick on the situation from the perspective of Britain. I really dealt with it from the perspective of the United States when I was at Penn. And one of the points I made there, though, which I think is worth thinking about, is that were there to be, as there is in California, this pressure for reparations, it's a little difficult to understand why Native Americans or Alaskans or Hawaiians or Filipinos, who were all, after all, brought under American control, should receive less or more compensation. And indeed, that if one wanted to extend the list, one could add, for example, if you have a certain point of view, Iraqis or Afghans as a result of the last 20 years. Now, that point, which was specific to the United States, is also with reference to the more general issue of Britain, Jermaine, even if the cast is a little different. And in the case of Britain, there is, after all, if you wish to use this idea of in some way guilt across the generations, and presumably that is what we're really talking about, inherited guilt, a view that incidentally has no legal basis and has a dubious philosophical base, but we'll leave that to one side. This is true of most of the half-baked arguments on favour of reparation. It is a little difficult to understand why, for example, you should treat the people who were slaves, which was obviously a terrible position to be in, with those people who also suffered in some way or other under British governance, some of them, of course, being British themselves, however defined. It's a little difficult, for example, to understand how those who went out to be convict labour in Australia should be treated somewhat differently. And obviously, that point, why on earth one should privilege one victimhood after and over another, and how on earth one is going to get into that situation, reflects what was actually quite clearly a historical moment. And that's the convergence of the rather ill-informed debate for compensation, reparation for slavery, with the specific British resonances of the Black Lives Matter movement. The two are, of course, totally different. And indeed, there is a rather ironic counterpoint, which is that in terms of Black Lives Matter in Britain, and of course, every single life matters, black, white, or any other colour, but in terms of Black, White Lives Matter, and the murder rate of young black males is reprehensible and outrageous, and it should be, everything possible should be done to stop it. It's also worth pointing out that the vast majority of the murderers are other black people. And this, in fact, not that that makes it better or worse, and this, of course, has a resonance if one is thinking in terms of slavery, because slavery itself was a widespread system across the world prior to the late 19th century. It was one of a number of coercive labor systems, all of which by modern standards are unacceptable. But slavery in terms of the Atlantic slave trade, and let's be clear about this, the reparations movement is very specific but very limited, really actually is highly ironic, an unfortunate irony, in that the slaves were available as a result of being enslaved by within Africa by other people of a similar hue. So in other words, rather than arguing that it in some ways is a racist matter of white cruelty towards blacks, one ought to say that there is cruelty in all systems. Probably you might argue the most heinous form of cruelty was committed in Europe in the shape of the Holocaust. So it's in no way a monopoly by any means of any particular colour, however you wish to define colour or race. But it has to be said that it would simply not have been possible to take part in the Atlantic slave trade if large numbers, millions of black people had not been enslaved by other black people. And one can take this a stage further. Far from this being some, as it were, pathology of the white system, far from that being the case, one could actually argue that if you look at African history since decolonization, if you think, for example, about terrible episodes such as the Biafran War and Nigerian Civil War of 1967 to 70, an area from which there was, of course, active slaving. If you think of the terrible conflicts in Congo, or Zaire, as it was otherwise known, in the 1990s and 2000s, another active area of slaving. Same with the Sudan in the 2000s and 2010s, and the same also in, for example, Angola from the 1970s through to the 1990s. All of these were areas of active local participation in the slave trade, and they are active areas in which there is terrible violence between African peoples at the present day or recently, as also, for example, in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, in Côte d'Ivoire. So in other words, with Cameroon, all of these were part of the slave coast. Sudan, of course, essentially fed the trans-Saharan slave trade. So it was somewhat different. And I think it's fair to say that cruelty is not simply a matter of slavery or linked to slavery. And one needs to be much more cautious about asserting that. But one can also take this a stage further. It seems to me somewhat bizarre that one gets people attacking the situation in the 16th or 17th or 18th centuries and doing very little or nothing about the cruelties of the present day. One can, of course, make this point even further, that in the case of Britain, of course, Theresa May, first as Home Secretary and then as Prime Minister, directed a lot of attention towards trying to make police act against what was known as the modern slave trade. And that referred to the extent to which people were being trafficked into Britain at the present day, of a variety of colours, many of them being used as either cheap labour, as with the Chinese workers who unfortunately died, the cockle pickers when Morecambe Bay, when they were drowned, or indeed as with people who are brought in for the sex trade. Now, there seems to me to be something very strange about the idea of pursuing a kind of supposed hereditary guilt and not, as it were, being concerned about the present day. Now, as you will well be aware, if you make this point, for example, about India, that yes, it was a terrible episode, Amritsar, absolutely appalling. It's also a terrible episode in Amritsar in the 1980s when the Indian government killed large numbers of Sikhs, or indeed Gujarat, in the 2000s, when the state government under Mr. Modi killed over 1,000 Muslims. And, you know, Indian commentators hate that. They call it whataboutery and argue that that is being used to excuse white crimes or British crimes. It's not being used at all in that purpose. What it is being used to do is to argue that people need to think through contextual factors and to not think that evil is specific to a particular moment and a particular group of individuals. Indeed, pursuing this, I personally do not think hereditary reparations as a good idea. But were you to want to pursue it in the British context, then you might argue that those of West Indian descent should be pursuing it as against those of African descent, Yorubas, for example, from Nigeria, many of whom were slave traders. Now, that would obviously be fantastical, as would, of course, the idea in the British context, the American context, or anywhere else, that you treat race as a immovable categorization. Now, we'll leave aside the absurdities of the present day, when people seem to be able to find that it's, that they feel that they can, as it were, just invent an identity. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the extent to which many people today are descended from or part of biracial relationships. And one wonders then how on earth this is supposed to play out in this issue of compensation. And the last point before switching over to Graham, which is this. My view is, I've argued this in my, I think now, three books on slavery and the slave trade. My view is that there is a degree to which, when we talk about slavery, we talk about what you might call the private capitalist form of slavery, though we tend to only talk about it in the Atlantic context, not, for example, in the Indian Ocean context or the Mediterranean context or so on. But of course, there is state slavery as well. From that point of view, from the point of view of state slavery, I think that what one would be better off doing is accepting that there is state slavery at the present day. I mean, examples of state slavery in the 20th century are, for example, people who were brutalized through work as opposed to being murdered straight out in concentration camps or in Soviet gulags. And you might argue the entire population of North Korea at the present moment is a state slave. And from that context, it seems rather bizarre that we're talking about the past. But, you know, that's my viewpoint, that there is something odd at the idea of hereditary guilt and people not being willing to confront the complexities of the present day. And I make that point. I think that point is relevant as far as all of the institutions we've been talking about who are making these kind of virtue signaling for reasons of their own. And I'm not in any way criticizing. I can understand the selfishness and the conceit which leads so many people to see a way to have a gravy train by pressing for recompense and by popping up in the BBC and sounding off about it. I can understand why they're doing it, but it doesn't mean that the rest should be paying any attention.
Well, I've certainly been paying attention, Professor Black, and I want to start by asking where you see or where you perceive a difference between compensation and reparations. After the Second World War, Germany and Japan did make compensatory payments. And of course, after the Napoleonic Wars and after the First World War, the French state after the Napoleonic Wars, the German state after the First World War made very significant reparations at a state level, though not to individuals. Where do you see that this history of compensatory payments made for damage that has been done either at an individual level or at a state level? And how do you see that as different to the reparations argument now, other than obviously that it's several generations removed?
Well, it's several generations removed, which is an important point. So it's not in any way compensating those who suffered, and nor is the compensation coming from those who caused suffering. And I think those are both germane. And in terms specifically of the Atlantic slave trade, it's a highly racist account because all fault is visited on the whites, and nobody seems to be much interested in the very powerful contribution made to the slave trade and the wealth that came from it by blacks in Africa. And one can take that a stage further, because this we're again an example of victimhood. And this is what is so misunderstood. I mean, I got interested in the slave trade because I'm by background a military historian. And the general line has been on military history in the early modern African Atlantic world, works like John Thornton's, for example, of how powerful the local states were and how they were able to see off the Europeans. Excellent work in particular on the situation in Angola. And but the same work can be thought of in West Africa if you're thinking about kingdoms like the Asante. So it then becomes rather curious that it's used as a kind of compensation for victimhood approach, when in fact it was only possible to have the slave trade because of the situation within Africa itself. Now, you then turn and you ask me perfectly fairly about these other cases. Well, 1815, the compensation which France had to pay was because, and it incidentally hadn't had to pay that in 1814 in the first, as it were, Congress of Vienna stipulations. It had to pay it because of Napoleon's coming back into power. It was a, as it were, a strong message from the European powers, accompanied by an occupation of part of France from 1815 to 1818, as you know, which was designed to say to those who had been part of this process, that was enough of, as it were, aggression. You have got to stop this. And it was a hard and delivered message. I don't think that's the same as thinking about something that, you know, we're talking about many generations past. I mean, you're thinking about the United States, slavery was abolished in 1865. If you're thinking about the British Empire, you're going back to the 1830s. So it's nobody alive today was part of that system. And I think one has to be very, very cautious before trying to argue that because of what were without doubt appalling circumstances in the past, they were appalling circumstances in the past, but it's very odd to decide that that should be visited on the present.
I suppose one of the arguments that is made, advanced particularly in the United States, is that this intergenerational victimhood has a real consequence, and that although slavery may have, slavery did end in the 1860s in the United States, the legacy of slavery continued in terms of the racism that so many African Americans experienced, and in many cases say they still do. And therefore, in that sense, the shadow of long past actions still has a consequence.
Well, I'm afraid to say, if one's going to take that attitude, we're going to spend all our life trying to decide who is and isn't to be compensated for what did or didn't allegedly happen to people who were earlier in their families, or indeed to they themselves. I mean, why not start a massive compensation thing because you've been, in your eyes, treated poorly at the present moment? I think one has to be very careful here. For the present generation within a country, there are legal means of redress. There are also, for those people who are not doing terribly well, there has been, in the British case, forms of welfare. We may not like them, but there have been forms of welfare going right back to the 19th century. In the American case, welfare has been more patchy, but there has been systems of state welfare since the 1960s. And many billions of dollars have been transferred those ways. Now, you might argue that you would like to have more. People can always say that. But that's not a terribly helpful process in thinking about how best to address issues in the present day. I mean, what precisely do you want to do? If you're British, for example, what aspects of current state expenditure would you like to ditch so that you could spend money on people who might feel that they could have been better looked after in the same sense that their ancestors might have made either more money if they hadn't been a slave or more money from selling slaves?
I mean, there's also the question of difficult experiences that past generations had, which weren't slavery. I mean, in the European context, one thinks of serfdom. It wasn't slavery, but it was very limiting on what individuals who were serfs could do and the lives they could lead. The abolition of serfdom, to my knowledge, I'll happily stand corrected, didn't come with any compensation.
No, it didn't come with any compensation. And we're talking, I mean, obviously, as you know, it took place for different territories at different steps. But we're talking about, for Russia, for example, in the late 19th century. And then, of course, you've also got indentured labour, you've got convict labour, we can see this because we could see the League of Nations in the 20s, the sources exist, debating what slavery was. I mean, that might seem to you to be an obvious point. Well, the League of Nations couldn't work out whether indentured labour was slavery or not, and they couldn't work out whether arranged marriages were slavery or not. And there is that gender dimension which is worth thinking about. So, no, you're absolutely right. And as you go on to say, there is the political scenario. In other words, should those American territories that do not have full statehood receive some form of compensation? I mean, I think this is an absurdity, but should everybody on the mainland be compensating Puerto Rico, for example, which has been under American rule, occupation, whatever term you wish to use, since 1898, when it was conquered? There was no free consent there, no more than there was in Hawaii. Or Alaska, which was just sold to it by Russia. So I think one's got to be a lot more sophisticated. And we've got a real lack of sophistication in much of the present discussion. There's a sort of notion of original sin, as it were, and this original sin is present in the slave trade. Well, there were lots of terrible things in the past. Yes. And there are lots of things we would not today do. Yes. Just as there are many things we today do, including me, like eating meat, which may appear to be absolutely appalling crimes to posterity. So we've got to bear in mind that you have to think about how you judge things. It is pertinent to judge things in terms of the values of that day. You have to be very cautious about assuming that a set of values is so obviously clear-cut that it must take precedence over every previous generation, and even more, that set of values is, what a surprise, that of the protagonist. I mean, let's give an obvious example. The Judaic, Christian, and Muslim traditions have all got, historically, a strong down on homosexuality, particularly homosexual sex. Now, what are we going to do? Are we going to be saying that, as it were, homosexuals today have to be compensated by all of those who were religious in the past? Or how are we going to supposedly do this? I mean, once you start to think about it, you realize how philosophically absurd it is, how intellectually suspect, how morally bizarre, because it often is linked not just with an idea that our values are obviously better, but also somehow that we are allowed to beat up on people in the past we don't like, but not those of the present day. And, bluntly, the world is in a mess at the moment. People are suffering in all sorts of countries as a result of conflict and brutality. In places like Myanmar, in Ethiopia, in Ukraine, why the hell should people think that it is pertinent in that context to put to the fore issues relating to several hundred years ago?
Well, I want really to ask a little bit about the history of this movement and this thought. I mean, when does it date from? Is it did it develop during the civil rights movements in the States in the 60s, or is it much later than that?
I mean, you obviously find some people at a number of stages saying, well, how do we compensate people? Interestingly enough, in the early 19th century, one of the ideas of compensation, and it was sometimes supported by white racists, but it wasn't just, there were also liberals who were the opposite of racists, was the idea that people who were slaves or freed slaves or had escaped slavery, and obviously those categories overlapped, or could overlap, should be given passage back to Africa, where, of course, settlements were established, Freetown by the British, obviously Monrovia, Liberia by the Americans. And that was regarded as a form of compensation to people of that generation. It also, obviously, was an attempt in the case of some races to clear out people they didn't want, who had mixed motives. I think if you're really looking for where we are at the present day, this is very much a matter of recent years. Although you can find some indications before the two teens, it's largely in the two teens that it gets going, and more recently, and of course, unfortunately, an issue which is a sensible issue, which is how do we discuss the legacy of slavery, and what is our ethical position at the present moment on it, which is, I think, a sensible issue, has been bound up with a kind of let's beat whitey over the head approach, which you see in some forms of culture war. And the last is, you know, I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, obviously, it's also linked to some pretty suspect, in my view, work in the field of so-called human rights law and human rights argumentation, because, of course, all of that is essentially decontextualized. It's all based upon the notion that the present is universally free and able to make moral statements that bind the past.
Why are the demands so strong in the English-speaking world? Why is this such an issue there? And not, you know, other nations were obviously deeply implicated in trading in slaves, and not least Turkey, for example, the Ottoman Empire, a massive slave empire. Why has the debate over reparations not taking hold in those countries as well, I wonder?
Well, I mean, there's no wonder about it, is it? I mean, it's part of the rather bizarre political culture we have in Britain and America. I mean, you say in Turkey, I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that according to the United Nations, and the figures are obviously problematic because we don't know, there are between 20 and 30 million slaves at the present moment in the world, far larger than the number actually transported in the Atlantic slave trade, incidentally, that these slaves are, many of them, in countries in the sub-Saharan belts of Africa, Mauritania, for example. And, you know, every so often you'll get these countries saying, oh, yes, we're totally opposed to slavery. And did they do anything? No, bugger all. And do the people like, you know, David Olusunga complain about it? No, not at all. I mean, it's much easier to beat up on, you know, the municipality of Bristol or whatever, or the National Trust, than to deal with something difficult like trying to stop Sudan being brutal Sudan, which is run essentially from an Islamic, lighter-skinned ruling group, if you like, and which regularly has, over the centuries, the millennia, you might like to say, has brutalized people from the southern parts of Sudan who are darker and who are of different religions, either animist or more recently Christian. Oh no, that's complicated. That's actually difficult. They won't get much publicity in Britain for that. So obviously they go and beat up on the easy targets.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's not much interest in tracking the profits made from contemporary slavery, unfortunately, at least not in universities, there isn't. But also, I don't detect much interest in following the 17th and 18th and early 19th century money in Africa, given that the vast majority of African slaves were enslaved in Africa by Africans. The various kingdoms and tribal chiefs and major slave traders made vast sums of money from this. But I'm not, and asked again, I happily stand corrected, but I'm not aware of scholarship pursuing where all the money that came into Africa and circulated through Africa as a result of its hundreds of years of being slave economies, where that money went, who has it now? It's curious, isn't it?
Yes, well, of course, it's one of the ironic things about the Benin bronzes that the Kingdom of Benin got this bronze essentially as payment for slaves. I'm not saying it was right to seize the bronzes. I'm just saying it's rather hilarious to see them presented in a attractive light.
Mm-hmm. Well, we must leave it there, Professor Black. But for giving us your perspective on the reparations debate and why it is riddled with issues and problems. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And besides my history of slavery, which has the original title, Slavery, A New Global History, and a couple of books on the slave trade, I've actually also discussed it in my brief history of the Atlantic, because there I'm talking also about societies like Morocco, a significant Atlantic society, and one that tends to be underplayed, which of course not just took part in slaving from south across the Sahara, and indeed for a while, as you will know, in the late 16th, early 17th century, had the Pashalik of Timbuktu under its control in the Niger Valley, but also, of course, from the Moroccan coast, from places like Sahli, slavers, Barbary pirates, they were referred to, raided the Atlantic coasts of Christendom, and not just of England and Ireland, places like my own home county now of Devon, but also as far up as Iceland. And I think it is worth bearing in mind that, alongside the paroxysms of guilt that you see engaged in by bodies like the Church of England, it is worth bearing in mind that in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, devout Anglicans actually organized themselves to pay money to slave states in order to try and, as it were, free Christian slaves from North Africa. And of course, that also led to British naval action against Algiers, for example, in 1816, and only stopped on the coasts of Algeria and modern-day Algeria and Morocco when there was European conquest. So I think that's worth bearing in mind, and it is worth bearing in mind the enormous effort made by the Royal Navy in trying to stamp out the illegal slave trade in the 19th century, not just in Atlantic waters, but also in the Indian Ocean. And a presentation of Britain's past simply in terms of slavery, without mentioning that Britons were also enslaved by others, that Britain made a major effort to have first the slave trade and then slavery banned elsewhere, such a one-sided message, which is all too typical of what we see coming out of a lot of the British debate, is inaccurate, and again, part of the broken trust between the generations, which is an aspect of this debate.
Professor Black, thank you very much indeed.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.